This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
My name's Julianne Pearce. I'm delighted to be chairing this session this morning. I'm the Executive Director of Australian Dance Theatre here in Adelaide, and I'm also the Chair of the Emerging and Experimental Arts Panel of the Australia Council. So welcome to this morning's session, Anxiety Meets Creativity, and great to see a great crowd here. It's obviously a topic that's piqued your interest. None of you look that anxious this morning, so you look all sort of fresh, but maybe by the end of it, we'll wait and see. So this morning I acknowledge that we are gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we respect their elders past and present. So just a little bit of housekeeping. Please switch your mobile phone to silent during the session, but you're welcome to use your phone during the session and Twitter and all of that. So the hashtag is hashtag ADLFOI. So hopefully you won't be that anxious to not send out lots of tweets from today's session. And please note that unauthorised recordings of any kind are not permitted during this session, and today's session is being audio recorded by Radio Adelaide for broadcast and future podcasts. So I ask when we do the Q&A towards the end of the session that you use the microphone just here to so that we can record your question. So, to today's panel, Anxiety Meets Creativity. This has been sparked by some ideas by the philosopher Kierkegaard, who argued that anxiety is essential for creativity. As a dual force, it can be both destructive and generative, depending on how we approach it. Our speakers today will discuss whether inner angst helps or hinders the creative process, and how they channel their inner demons without assuming the fetal position. So, you know, as we know, anxiety is a modern condition. You know, there's a lot of anxiety around us now. And, you know, what does happen when anxiety meets creativity? You know, do they have a big hug? Do they get on? Do they, have a polite handshake, or do they start brawling immediately? You know, we are very aware that anxiety and creativity is a very dynamic but often tense relationship. And we look at the work of someone like Woody Allen, who's infamous for bearing all of his anxieties and phobias on the screen in a wonderful sort of outpouring of creativity. So in a case like Woody Allen, his anxiety is an incredible sort of dynamic force for his artistic output. I must admit to a bit of chair's anxiety myself with such a great panel this morning, but hopefully you'll see more creativity than anxiety from me this morning. But just to introduce the speakers to you now, Gary Greenberg, who's on the far right there, is based in Connecticut, and he said to me today how wonderfully friendly everyone is in Adelaide. So he's got a big smile on his face, so he's loving it here, even though we are in the bowels of the Masonic Lodge. So Gary is a practicing psychotherapist and author of Manufacturing Depression and the Noble Life. Gary will talk about the phenomenon of anxiety and how psychiatrists and psychologists have seen it over the years, and how no matter the school of thought, the tendency to pathologise anxiety conflicts with the artistic impulse. Anna Goldsworthy, who many of you would know, I'm sure, has been very busy this Festival of Ideas. She's just come from a panel that I've been at, 50 Shades of Feminism. So this is, I hope this is going to be a sort of another stimulating topic for you, Anna. But Anna is an award-winning pianist and writer. Her best-selling memoir, Piano Lessons, won Newcomer of the Year at the Australian Book Industry Awards. Anna will talk a little bit about the role of anxiety and obsession as a generator of her work, but also as a subject of her work. There's an episode in her recent memoir, Welcome to Your New Life, which is essentially a transcription of a panic attack. And Anna will talk about this and also read from it, which will be great. And also welcome to Peter Drew, who's recently returned from Glasgow, where he was undertaking a research master's at the Glasgow School of Art in working on street art. And that, what was the topic of your research?
It was street art and graffiti, but why they don't fit with institutions.
Yeah, so I think Peter's going to expand a bit on that today, and his problems with academia, I think, who as he says, ironically enough, his research at the school examined the tension between large institutions and urban art, but yet he was threatened with expulsion for, I don't know, what did you do, graffiti, the provosts?
there were posters that I stuck up, and they liked them, and then they didn't like them.
Okay. So, okay, that's a good start. So enough of me, and I'm going to hand it over to Gary.
Thank you. So despite the overwhelming friendliness that I've encountered here in Australia, which actually for a while I was taking it personally and thinking, oh, they really like me. But then I realized it's just, you know, sort of the cultural norm. But despite all of that, the other day, I think two nights ago, I woke up in bed and was possessed with this feeling of dread. I was nauseated. I was sweaty. I was frightened. I crawled across that 3-hectare bed that they supplied me with at the Hilton and looked at the clock, and it was 2:27 in the morning. And I thought, well, one thing's for sure, I finally adjusted, because that's about when I wake up at home with those feelings. I hope you're feeling a little sorry for me. I was feeling a little sorry for myself. But the interesting thing that happened that night, and I was more aware of it because I was thinking about this presentation, was that I went through the whole like list. Well, what is it? What's going on here? You know, there's this whole thing in the Bible about God calling out to Abraham and Abraham responding, "Here I am," you know. And this was the Kierkegaardian view about anxiety, was that it was a call. So the question was, who's calling me? What is this about? And so I went through the list, you know, did I leave the iron on at home? Am I having a heart attack and I'm about to die? What's going to happen with my kid as he gets older? You know, does my wife still love me even though I've been away for 2 weeks and left her alone with him, you know? And on and on. And what occurred to me later, after I went back to sleep and woke up not feeling this anymore, was that when we feel a feeling like that, and perhaps everybody in this room has felt something like that, that anxiety feeling, the dread, we're compelled to find a story to tell ourselves about why do we feel this way. Now, I don't know if that's a modern thing. I mean, obviously, this is the only time I've ever lived that I know of. But I do know that that is the modern, that both of these are the modern condition. Anxiety is the modern condition. It's how most of us dip into it one time or another. And telling the story is also a modern condition. We tell stories, and sometimes increasingly we know that they're only stories. Now, my racket, the psychotherapy racket, is really a storytelling racket. And what we do is we have different ways of telling that story, from the one about how it's biology. You know, I just got bad chemicals, and they're making me at 2:27 in the morning have this feeling, and it's probably got something to do with low blood sugar, and it's the emergency. You know, I wish we had idiot lights instead of pain, but that would be intelligent design. But, you know, the story is that there's something gone wrong in my body. There's a story told about behavior, that certain behaviors are associated with a certain feeling, and that when you encounter that behavior, when you encounter that stimulus again, you have the feeling, maybe it's because I'm alone in a big city that I'm not familiar with. There's the cognitive behavioral story that I'm telling myself, I've got bad thoughts, you know, and I'm being pessimistic, and really I'm not going to die, so why should I feel bad? And there's the Freudian story that anxiety is about sort of unsettled intrapsychic conflict. And all of these stories have the same effect, and this is something I need to apologize for, I think, and apologize in the sense of saying sorry, which is that in my field, what we do is we tend to take anxiety as a symptom of an illness, as something that's bad. Now, there's no question that it's uncomfortable, but the question is it sick? And we don't really know how to answer that question. We can look at it in terms of disability. If the anxiety is so bad you can't function, then there must be something wrong with it. But I think we've done the world a disservice, because I think that it is true that, if I think about the writing I've done, that the anxiety, when it isn't making me curl up into a fetal position on my enormous bed in the Hilton, is useful. And here's why. Because I think that underneath all of this stuff that we do with our stories and our lives and our making money and all of that, underneath all of that is this current of raw presence. And out of that current, if you can dip into it, out of that comes art, whatever the art is. Out of that comes inspiration. So in my experience, these moments, like the one in the Hilton, have been the fount in some way, if not directly, then indirectly, an indication that I'm about to, that something is about to happen. And to dismiss this as sickness is a bad idea. But what we're not very good at, and there's one school of psychotherapy that I think takes care of this, which is the existentialist school of psychotherapy, which encourages us to look at our anxiety. And what it really does is it encourages us to strengthen our ability to do that. We don't learn this well enough as children and as grown-ups to tolerate our negative feelings. And if there's one thing that I think is really important to be able to do to get on in life that a life that seems to offer all sorts of opportunities for hard-to-tolerate feelings, is to learn to tolerate them. Because when you do that, and this has been my experience anyway, when I do that, then I'm able to dip in and get beyond the world of everyday appearances and find something else, find something that's worth writing about, that's worth talking about. And that's what I'm hoping I've done with the experience that I had at the Hilton.
Perhaps we can just explore a little bit more this idea of anxiety as a sickness. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts would be on, you know, the more anxious you are, does that make you a better artist? Or it's, you know, where, at what point does anxiety stop being a sickness that makes us ill? You know, I mean, there's so many of us on sort of antidepressants, and, you know, at what point do we use that, take that anxiety and turn it into something else?
Yeah, I don't, and I think it's, I hesitate to make a universal statement about that, because as much as it might sound like I'm weaseling out of answering the question, it really does depend on the individual. I mean, what we have here is, first of all, we have temperaments. Some of us are more prone to feeling what we call anxiety than others, and that just across the board. And so those people are saddled with more of it. And some people, when they take the drugs, whether it's Xanax or Valium or antidepressants or marijuana or alcohol, which, by the way, is the greatest anti-anxiety, not that I'm recommending it, but it is a tremendous anti-anxiety
helps,
drug.
Doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And you know, before the age of modern medicine, people drank. They still drink, especially here, I've noticed. But
that's why everyone looks so happy.
That's it. I've made the connection now. I thought it was the lithium in the water, but everybody has their response to the drugs as well as to the anxiety. So the question is really a question about cultivation. Given your own baseline, given your own level of anxiety, tendency to anxiety, what can you do to cultivate it? Some people, in order to do that, have to take drugs. So there's no way to say that the more anxious you are, the more artistic you are, or if you take drugs, you're not going to be able to be creative. But what you don't want to lose sight of is that in that anxiety is the inspiration, somewhere buried in there. And for some of us, it's harder to get at than others. Some of us are lucky we have anxiety all the time.
I mean, just one more quick question for me is, I mean, why is it the middle of the night that you wake up with that.
So something
have
about,
you done any research?
Something about serotonin, I think.
Is that, yeah?
No. because the middle of the night is when everything is quiet.
Yeah.
It's when you're in a defenseless state, and the reality of mortality, which is, you know, this is the great thing about humans. We're the only animals that seem to have a sense of mortality. Isn't that wonderful? You know, if you didn't know you were going to die, it wouldn't be such a problem. And so, you know, you just live your life thinking, of course, we all do that, right? We have that myth we're not going to. But I think that it's when it sneaks up on you.
Anna or Peter, did you want to respond to...
And I was going to wait.
Okay. Well, I think Gary's laid sort of a very rich groundwork for our conversation. So I'll just sort of hand over to Anna now.
Yeah, thank you. Look, I'm intrigued by this notion that inspiration lies within anxiety, and I guess I can really only speak from my case, but I suspect it is at least partly true. I do think, though, that there's probably in sort of optimal quantity of anxiety that's super productive for me, and that beyond that it actually becomes sort of paralyzing. And I might sort of start by talking about my own experience as a musician, as a pianist. And I think anxiety plays into that in a number of ways. I know when I was a child I could only go to sleep at night if my father was playing the piano in the adjacent room. It was supremely reassuring. And I've read somewhere it's been said that the ear is the organ of fear, and there's something really primal about music, I think, that it soothes us. And so perhaps part of my attraction to music as a slightly anxious person, or occasionally an extremely anxious person, arises from that. But beyond that, if you are a pianist, a performing musician, you know, you're forced to practice for long hours every day. And I think perhaps if you don't have an obsessive temperament, which I may be wrong, but I suspect is in some ways connected to an anxious temperament. I mean, certainly for me, my anxiety at times has felt like just another form of my obsessiveness. It'd be difficult to put in the requisite hours, you know, 5-6 hours a day practicing when you're growing up. And if there wasn't the spectre of these sort of terrible possibilities for public humiliation in the form of concerts on the horizon, perhaps one would be less inclined to practice. So anxiety in that sense is a useful motivating factor. But then beyond that, we get to the whole issue of performance, of stepping on stage. Now, in my first memoir, which is Piano Lessons, which sort of charts my own musical upbringing, I think in retrospect what I was seeking to do was to dispel some of the mystique that we cultivate when we're on stage. You know, we like to give the impression as performers that everything's under control, and that we're these terribly serene beings that are somehow just able to access these masterworks. And yet behind that, there's a tremendous amount of work, clearly, but also probably, and certainly in my case, panic. And part of what that book is, I guess, is a transcription of the anxiety of being a performer. And after it was published, my very first interview was with the novelist Andrea Goldsmith. And you know, she said to me, "I think you've written a definitive book about anxiety." And how ironic that as an anxious person you were attracted to this particular sphere of work in which, you know, anxiety, I suppose, is a large component of performance. Now, I was intrigued when I heard Gary say that one of the ways we respond to anxiety is by constructing stories. And when I think of the way my mind acts when I'm on stage, and this is what I mean about you want a sort of optimal amount of anxiety, I think before you go on stage, if you're not feeling a slight adrenaline rush, then you're in trouble because you just don't care. And that adrenaline can be terrifically powerful. You can harness it for good as well as for evil, and it can actually make you perform at your very, very best. If it gets a little bit too much, then it can be debilitating, and then it can actually stop you from performing. And in my case, certainly growing up, I think it was the stories that resulted from that anxiety that would cause me trouble on stage. Because it's when a performance is not going well, that's when the chattering is going on in your head. And the chattering usually takes the form of, "Hey, wouldn't it be kind of funny if I had a memory lapse on the next page?" Or, you know, do I really know this piece? Or imagine if this were to happen. And what I did find writing this particular memoir was it was much, much easier for me to write about bad performances than it was about good performances. And I think the reason was that good performances were largely silent in terms of that chattering, anxiety-provoking voice. So yes, you do actually inhabit some place very sporadically of grace, where you're just in the moment. But when you're not in the moment, that's when there's that little demon in your shoulder doing all that talking. Now, that's not useful to me, particularly as a pianist on stage. It's fabulous for the practice studio, because it's what allows you to second guess your art and improve. It is quite useful, though, I think, as a writer. I think a literary sensibility does have to be obsessive in that way. Then I had children, and I found that a lot of my anxiety just shifted from my concert life to my children. And in a curious way, that was quite liberating to me professionally, and I feel I've actually done my best work as a performer since I've been a little bit less anxious about it, still sufficiently anxious to care, but not to that really paralysing extent. But I did find that I had this wonderful new source of anxiety, and I wrote another memoir. And I'm not consciously trying to write memoirs of anxiety. I guess I'm just writing memoirs of what's obsessing me at the time. And for a long time, that was music. And over the past 4.5 years, it's been my kids. And so I thought I might actually read an excerpt from this book. It's called Welcome to Your New Life. And it's about that first sort of delirious year when you can't even really think straight. And when you have this new thing in your life that causes you to panic. And this is about when we had a 2-month-old baby, and we decided to try to take a holiday, not yet realising that holidays are no longer possible. The cast of this little excerpt are my partner Nicholas and my child, my son, who I just referred to as you. And so we arrive at this holiday house in Apollo Bay on the Great Ocean Road. The house is spacious, immaculate as a magazine spread, with light flooding in from all sides. There are wide decks, forest vistas, smooth linen and fine crockery, and a large table of distressed wood on which I can write. It is a holiday house that promises everything, including the opportunity to reclaim myself. Why was it such a bargain? Nicholas takes out his camera to document the house, to confirm its existence. No idea. I feed and change you as the dog rushes outside to caper on the lawns. Afterwards, I place you on the daybed by the window where you make celebratory noises and then abruptly fall asleep. Odd that there's no air conditioning, Nicholas says, coming in from the deck. Oh, once we open it up, there'll be a gully breeze. A gully breeze on top of a hill? I move through the house, flinging doors and windows open. Of course. It's only when I go to the toilet that I discover a flaw in this paradise. There is a sign. This is a composting toilet. Please drop in a scoop of sawdust mixture after every use. I open the lid to an underground sea of shit yawning back at me. Afterwards, there is not the closure of a flush, only a scoop of sawdust into its greedy maw. Quickly, I close the lid, but it is too late. I have seen how you would fall. That moment in which clumsiness ticks over into disaster. The dense plummet of your body. The viscous splash. The too small hole through which I could never follow you. It is yet another of these vortices, these sinkholes, and even after I've run from the room and slammed the door, I feel its sinister gravitational pull. What's wrong? Asks Nicholas, jiggling you on his lap in the living room. There's a long drop toilet. He stands to investigate, and I snatch you from his arms. The baby must never go in there. I take you into the dining room and close the door. I don't think you should be scared of the toilet, he says, coming in. What if the baby fell in? How would he get in there? He's incapable of locomotion. One of us might take him in. So we won't take him in. But our holiday house has been exposed as a fraud, as a front for the composting toilet with its diabolical appetites. In the kitchen, the thermometer rises to 45 degrees and the dog unravels another inch of pink tongue. At dusk, a plague of insects descends upon the house and we run from room to room, closing windows so that the insects thud against the glass. I put you to bed and we sit down to watch The Sopranos. There is still no sign of a gully breeze. Always I am aware of the composting toilet, of its patient waiting. It is too hot to be awake, and when we go to bed, it is too hot to be asleep. Even lying naked is an exertion. Nicholas falls asleep regardless, while my heart rate accelerates. I try to slow it with logic. You are incapable of locomotion. The only people capable of taking you into the composting toilet are me and Nicholas. I repeat these statements in my head as though counting sheep. You are incapable of locomotion. The only people capable of taking you into the composting toilet are me and Nicholas. I will not take you into the composting toilet. Therefore, the person who will take you into the composting toilet is Nicholas. I knew it. It is incontestable as a mathematical proof, but I turn it round further in my head, searching for fallacies. Even though Nicholas has said he will not take you in, he does not properly appreciate the threat. There is a danger that he will forget and take you anyway and then accidentally drop you in. And there's the additional danger that he might take you in his sleep. It is important that I remain awake to prevent this. But if I stay awake now, I might fall asleep tomorrow, leaving you alone with Nicholas and at greater risk. I get out of bed and arrange a small pile of suitcases by his side of the bed, so that if he gets up in the night, he will trip and alert me. Then I climb back into bed and wrap my arms around him, my leaking breasts adhering to his back. It's too hot. He tries to shake me off, but I clasp my hands more tightly until his body slackens with sleep. You are incapable of locomotion. The only people capable of taking you into the composting toilet are me and Nicholas. Sometime around midnight, a baby mouse scurries into the room and I shoot it with my hunting gun. Why did I have to do this? Who would have thought a small mouse could contain so much blood? What's wrong? Nicholas asks. I just had the most terrible nightmare. He turns over. What happened? I can scarcely talk through disorientation and terror. I dreamt that I shot a mouse. For a moment he is still, but then his belly trembles with laughter and he heaves himself up in bed. Where are you going? To the toilet. Before he's climbed out of bed, I've rushed to your room to stand sentry at your door. There is a loud thud from the master bedroom. What the fuck? I'm just checking on the baby, I explain as he limps by. I'm still loitering by your door when he returns. There's something you should know, he says, taking my hands in his. I'm not planning to take the baby out of bed in order to drop him down the composting toilet. Shh, I never thought you were. We return to bed where he falls asleep and I resume my calculations. The only people of taking you into the composting toilet are me and Nicholas. I will not take you into the composting toilet. I sense a flaw in my logic, the dawning of a new possibility. What if I were to carry you there in my sleep? This is a knight's move, checkmate. If I cannot trust myself with you, whom can I trust? Tears form in my eyes and dry immediately in the heat. My pulse thuds in my ears. As I lie there, paralyzed by fear of myself, another sound starts in cross rhythm, a sound that part of me always knew was coming, the urgent squeal of the smoke alarm. And then the smoke alarm goes off and it looks as if we may be in the middle of a bushfire, which really added to my feeling of relaxation. So I take the baby outside. I do not wish to return inside into that parody of shelter. If I am holding you, I can monitor you for signs of dehydration. If I am holding you, Nicholas cannot drop you into the composting toilet. If I remain awake, I will not be surprised by fire. I sit and wait, held taut by my triangulated fears. How foolish to imagine we could escape the heat or exhaustion or our anxiety. Beneath my palm, I feel the busy work of your digestion and I glance down at the great dome of your sleeping head, at your champignon nose, at the beak of your upper lip. Bringing a child into this world is exposing it to danger. I thought I understood this, that I had read the fine print. Blithely, I signed my name on the dotted line. But not being able to keep you safe is intolerable. Even if I succeed in shielding you from bushfire, from composting toilets, from intestinal spillage, from all the wormholes of daily existence, both natural and man-made, there is still the danger that you might suddenly die in the night for no reason at all. What cosmic sadist invents such a system designed to torment parents and then throw sleep deprivation into the mix? And even if we manage to duck and weave the perils of infanthood, then childhood and adolescence and make it through to adulthood, who is to say you will not move to London and be struck down by hemorrhage during a routine operation? So, you know, speaking about anxiety attacks in the wee small hours of the night, I'm sort of terribly terribly prone to them. Yeah, and having children has just added this extra sort of extra element of night terror, which is slightly less pronounced than it was a couple of years ago, but still very much part of my life.
Okay, thank you, Anna. It's quite a raw experience, very well described. I think you've left us all with a very strong image of sort of death by compost toilet as well. So I'm sure there'll be questions for Anna, but I'm pleased to hand over to Peter Drew now.
Thanks. I think, yeah, that's a great story. I think I'd say I think we're all very familiar that anxiety is a terrific topic for comedy, but anxiety does all sorts of different things. I mean, I feel a little bit anxious now, but I don't think it's necessarily going to make me a better speaker. You might have some anxiety later when you're looking for your car, trying to remember where you've parked it, but it's not necessarily going to make you better at finding it. I think that there are lots of different types of anxiety, but the type that we're really talking about today, or at least the type that I think Kierkegaard's talking about, is the sort of existential angst, the type of anxiety about that Anna also touched on in the story about death, about being aware that we are going to pass away and that everything that gives our life meaning will disappear as well. And I think that's when art does touch on those things, it's very powerful, but that's not everything that art does. Art can do all kinds of different things, and I don't think you need to feel anxiety to make great art. One thing I did want to speak about in particular is that it's a modern idea, that this connection between anxiety and creativity. It's not something we associate with Renaissance artists, for instance. If you read Vasari and the Lives of the Great Artists, they are described as geniuses, and their genius is about inspiration in terms of through religion and God. Kierkegaard, mid-19th century, talking about the relationship between creativity and anxiety, is really the decline of art's relationship with religion, and then art needing to find some other way of filling that gap, of saying art can still bring spiritual truth, except it doesn't necessarily have to come through religion, it's coming through the individual's ability to feel sort of mental stress, anxiety, going close to the point of insanity. I mean, it's sort of departing from what is the normal, everyday sort of experience of the world. It's that waking up in the middle of the night and sort of having that feeling. And so you get artists like Van Gogh, who are like sort of a messiah of that idea. It actually destroyed him, and the entire sort of narrative that surrounds his life is one sort of struggling with anxiety to the point of insanity. But that's at a point when that idea was still somewhat fresh. It's the beginning of the modern era. Then midway through the modern era, you get artists like Salvador Dali and Surrealism, which is a sort of a method for drawing out mental stress, and it becomes a performance. I mean, anyone that's familiar with Dali's work, I mean, I like it as much as the next person, but you have to admit that he's aware that he's acting a little bit crazy, and that has a sort of a performative aspect to it. So, and then in the contemporary era, it seems that the idea is less and less fashionable to be crazy or to have anxiety, and that sort of personal hardship is what you use to imbue your art with value. I think that there are the sort of work that I like to make, I hope that there's times when it does sort of require some sort of personal anxiety, and that's in the work. And I love art that shows that. You can see that the artist has somehow suffered, or at least that they're aware of some sort of personal suffering. But I'm very interested in work which is more collaborative and is much more about explaining things out in the world. Art which is sort of politically focused, you don't necessarily care whether the artist had a tough upbringing and they can't sleep at night. If they are saying something profound about how we can get along better as a society. So art can do all sorts of different things. I'd say that definitely anxiety does help art, but it's not necessary. And I think we should be very sceptical of the idea that artists feeling anxiety is the only way that you can give some spiritual worth or some existential worth to art. In terms of my own work, what I actually look for and the thing that I sort of focus on, rather than focusing on my own anxiety, I focus on conflict between different people, myself and institutions, myself and other artists. And I think that's how I find value. Take, for example, what happened with the school. I was studying at the Glasgow School of Art, and they accepted me on the basis of my street art, which was the vast majority of which was illegal. And then halfway through the course, they decided to kick me out. To stop me from doing that or kick me out. I was given the choice of stop the illegal work or we'll kick you out of the school. I thought, this is a conflict. This is an interesting thing. It's going to give more meaning to what I'm doing. I didn't want to I don't think it really had very much to do with the fact I was going to die or anything like that. It was more that when people have disagreements because they have different values, should explore those and draw out the conflict in a mature way. And it mostly was mature. I'm glad that it all sort of turned out well in the end. And it did definitely give that sort of... that's what anxiety does as well in any conflict. It puts things under enormous pressure. You sort of feel the stress and the weight of everything. And that conflict really put me under a great deal of pressure. Now I can look back and just sort of laugh about it. But at the time, it was going to get kicked out and sent home, so it wasn't much fun. But I think it helped in the end. So,
yeah, I think perhaps just be interesting to talk a little bit about that experience at Glasgow, because art schools used to be a place that sort of nurtured anxiety and I guess really nurtured that sort of expression from students. But it seems that art schools themselves are full of anxiety and setting rules and boundaries. And, you know, for you as an artist to be supported to create a body of work, that then they sort of stop you from doing that by their rules. How was that for you being in an art school? Because I think there is this whole shift, and I mean, you alluded to that the role, that how art is being created is shifting. And, you know, because there isn't that anxiety or that political sort of pressure, that the art schools are embracing that as well as a model for learning.
Yeah, well, I definitely didn't expect to find the conflict that I did. I expected to find a nurturing environment in which I'd be sort of... Well, not mollycoddled, but sort of but taken care of but have my ideas challenged. But I think I was really surprised to find as much insecurity as I did. Something that I remember when I studied, I did my undergraduate degree in psychology at the Adelaide University, and one of the most interesting things I remember learning about the way that academics sort of carry themselves is that just the way that there's a tendency amongst... the mathematicians and academics that are of a discipline which is quantifiable and you can easily show the value of what you're doing, such as mathematicians. You can either solve the equation or you can't. They have a way of sort of letting themselves go physically or sort of not, I mean, in terms of their parents have, you know...
That happens to all of us, Peter.
No. But the point I'm making is that everyone knows how good they are. They don't have to show off in a way. Whereas when things are not so quantifiable, very subjective things like visual art or anything in the arts, people there's a lot more affectation in terms of how people sort of display and externalize their status because there's no way for them to actually prove it. Sorry, I just realised I'm not sure how I got onto it, but I mean,
that's a really interesting point, because if you think about the way the institutions, and this is probably maybe too much parochial, but the institutions that we work in, whether it's the art institutions or the writing institutions, they're set up to create maximal anxiety for us content providers.
Sure.
You know, there's a way in which that insecurity that you're describing is what the business side of it thrives on. They're, you know, keeping us guessing about where the next money is coming from, where the next approval is coming from, the whole criticism business. I mean, it's true that it's a, if anxiety is a wellspring of art, then they're doing a really good job of cultivating it for us.
Yeah, I think I agree, and I think in a musical setting you also have international music competitions, which are just designed to torture people. You know, I heard a commentator say that sort of irony is what you're seeking in these fora is artists who have these incredibly sensitive souls, and yet at the same time you have to have the hide of a rhinoceros. Now, who can reconcile these two things? But you can only really, I suppose, win an international piano competition if you somehow paradoxically manage to have both. And likewise, masterclass is a very large part of growing up as a musician, which is essentially a sort of a gladiatorial forum in which you're just subject to public humiliation. So, yeah, they're doing a great job.
What does it truly makes you stronger?
Yeah.
So, look, we've got about 15 minutes for questions. Please, you know, don't be shy. We've covered a lot of ground here, and, you know, we're really keen for you to contribute as well.
Hi, I've just got a question, just something that Gary mentioned right at the beginning. Was talking about training for dealing with negative emotions. Now, if you're training children to be in this, you know, 21st century world, would you subject it's just a hypothetical idea, to a concert where they actually have to make mistakes and they're going to be criticised and stuff like that to make them stronger? Or like train to deal with these negative emotions, like they're going to happen. But if you have a child that's just had lots and lots of praise from the beginning, is that, you know, what do you suggest if you're for teachers or for people, even adults, to do with negative emotions or if they have anxiety?
Well, I personally don't think we've done our children any great service by focusing so much on what's great about them, and I'm not sure I fully understand the shift, the cultural shift. Whereby this has happened, the idea that we protect them from suffering is sort of like the idea that we protect them from germs, which we've also done a good job at, and that seems to be where a lot of the asthma is coming from. I think that when it comes to parenting, the important distinction regarding anxiety is whether it's about us or about them. And I think a lot of the times when we're trying to protect our children from suffering, we're protecting ourselves because we feel it so intensely. And watching your child suffer or bearing the consequences of their suffering is really a hard thing to do, but sometimes is what you have to do. Adam Phillips, who's a brilliant psychoanalyst in England, wrote that the biggest job of parenting is learning how to let your children hate you. And it's absolutely true. And that means that you have to be able to tolerate that feeling, and it also conveys to them that they can tolerate the feeling of whatever it is they're feeling. You know, you don't jump in to rescue them from it. So
would you think exposing them to more to negative situations?
I think we should just beat them.
Yeah, sure.
The second time I've heard that, one of them came up in your session before. Okay.
This is a question more for Anna. You said so eloquently when you described the anxiety that comes from your performance and the sort of compulsive nature of being a performer. I was just wondering, when you get to that point where your performance in music is the source of that sort of paralytic style anxiety, how is you resolve that and potentially even use that to be able to perform despite it?
Yeah, I think you develop a fitness for it, probably, and it's about being exposed to that anxiety over many years, and you develop strategies too for dealing with it, which is not to say, you know, any of us, any performers are subject to just occasionally being ambushed by paralysing anxiety. You know, violinists speak about just getting the bow shakes out of nowhere. And, I mean, for me, there's an aspect of surrender that has allowed me to, if you're prepared and you get up on stage and then you just sort of, it's in the hands of the angels. And it's a kind of leap of faith, but that's something that sort of helped me get through it. I also think the more you practice, my piano teacher always said the stage must be like another room in your house. It's not quite that for me yet, but it's certainly a much less terrifying place than it once was.
Any other tips for young musicians?
Oh gosh, there's a bookload of them. It's called Piano Lessons.
Okay. Peter, you mentioned that you expressed a scepticism that anxiety is required, or that anxiety is a driving force behind a lot of art. And then you went on to say that conflict drives a lot of your work. Isn't that essentially then feeding on the audience's own anxieties in response to that conflict, and therefore actually still, you know, the perception of your art still requiring the anxiety, just not from you, it's from the other side?
Inflicting it.
Yeah.
Inflicting it. I've never thought of it that way. That's quite a funny funny way of putting it. I mean, I guess it depends on how broad you want to make the definition of anxiety. I really just wanted to make the point that, I mean, there's the anxiety that you are meant to feel because you know you're going to die, and that coming into creating work, it's the that existential angst. I think that all art must have anxiety in it. If someone made art without any sort of grain of anxiety, then that would be, I'd
looks like oil Elvis on oil painting. Yeah, oil painting on velvet, you know.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's actually, I mean, it's, look, there are contemporary artists now that sort of claim to not feel. I mean, Jeff Koons is a good example. He sort of claims that he doesn't feel any sort of anxiety in his work. It's like a deliberate pose to sort of go against the modernist requirements of being an artist. You have to be tortured and it's so difficult to make it. So he says, I don't feel any anxiety, and he turns out these sort of serene, shiny. Dogs. I mean, it's as much a pose as it is to be crazy, and sort of, or to be too anxiety ridden. So I think that it's anxiety is optional, I guess, is what I'd say. Yeah.
Can I comment on that? I was really intrigued by that comment also, and the example you said was the Renaissance, and what's interesting about that is that prior to the Renaissance, and really just at the end of the Renaissance, there wasn't really very much of an idea of inner life. You know, this idea that our inner life is important and we should pay attention to it, at least if you weren't an aristocrat, and even then, that's why the Confessions of St. Augustine are so incredible for their time. And that's why Shakespeare is so sort of the beginning of this idea of introspection. And so I think that it's a really, I've never really made that connection before, but that is a really interesting difference between art prior to the age of the modern self and what we have now.
Sure.
Yeah, that's...
And in fact, I was reading a book talking about that just last night, which is great. And the idea, too, that, you know, genius wasn't something you owned. The genies lived in the wall, and they came out and you weren't responsible for your book. It was if you had good luck or bad luck, whether the genies who lived in your house were good writers or not. Having thought about the middle of the night quite a lot, being an anxious person, sorry, this is very convoluted. It's a very convoluted question. A couple of things come to mind. One is the Chinese thing about your different organs processing things at different times, and it's like, okay, 4 o'clock, it's your liver. So if you've had too much to drink or been eating heavy food, that's the liver anxiety. But there's another, I was reading a little while ago about the idea of the middle of the night. Once upon a time, we all got up in the middle of the night. There were the middle of the night prayers, the middle of the night poetry. You could visit other people in the middle of the night. And that human beings are actually in a different state of sleep, so that today's idea of modern anxiety was actually that time of awakeness in the middle of the night was actually a time of meditation, of creativity, of prayer, of connection of self, of connection of others in a really quiet way that we've really lost these days. So that's not a question either. Something to think about.
Nice point, though.
I guess my question, you were speaking a minute ago about Jeff Koons. I know for myself as a creative person, when I've been incredibly happy, I've been going, what the hell do I make art about? What the hell do I write about? How can I be happy and flowery and bright and joyful and...
There is that cliche, yeah. You know, happiness writes white. It doesn't actually have any meaning on the page. I don't know if it's entirely true. I mean, it's sort of sad to think that we have to cultivate angst in order to create. And yet it can be a useful... I guess it's sort of like the oyster making a pearl in the shell. It's the irritant, isn't it? And trying to work a way out of it. Or it's sometimes a way to make something beautiful.
Yeah. And is it a bad thing? I mean, why is anxiety uncomfortable? Why, you know... Keats and Byron and, you know, the melancholy poets. We wouldn't have had that poetry if they'd all been on antidepressants.
Well, it's this notion too, and I think, you know, Gary sort of touched on this. Are we designed to be happy 24/7? I don't think we are. I think we're designed to exist with a degree of discomfort. And do we medicate our way out of that? Do we try to cure us? But sometimes the process of trying to deal with that, I think, actually ends up being the creative process, at least for me.
But I also think there are some very inherent... You know, I think this idea of anxiety and creativity as a modern phenomenon or creativity coming out of anxiety, because a lot of what I think you've been talking about your experience of masterclasses and concerts is this whole flight or fright, you know, and it's like your compulsion is to run and leave the room, but, you know, you stay and you play the music. And, you know, so I think there is some very... You know, I don't want to sound essential, but the inbuilt into us is this sort of capacity to overcome that and go, okay, I'm going to sit here at the piano and, what would be your response to that, perhaps, Peter? That I'm just interested to flesh out this, you know, in the few minutes we've got left. I mean, why is it such a modern concept? Oh, and there are a couple of questions, so.
So why is it such a modern concept?
Yeah.
That anxiety and creativity connect together. Well, I think that it's actually less and less in fashion. I think that irony is so much more in fashion in creative fields, and that doesn't really require... In fact, it requires sort of a denial of anxiety in a way. To me, irony is a good way of curing anxiety. It's laughing it off. It's realising that the world's pretty absurd. We're going to die. We're here. We've got all these meaning surrounding us, and... But you know what? It's all going to go, and that's kind of ironic. that's the way I like to create as well. I mean, I slightly distrust any art that doesn't have at least some sort of element of wit or irony in there. I do love seeing work that's obviously the artist has suffered and the anxiety is there, but it's there's an element of vanity to that as well, that sort of that person's inner inspiration is so important. It's nice to sort of to see that they don't take themselves too seriously as well. So I like irony.
If you think about that fight and flight thing that you just mentioned as an old, you know, evolutionarily developed thing for whatever we were doing 100,000 years ago, and then you put it into the modern world, what you create is the grounds for feeling an intense feeling and not knowing whether to believe it. The anxiety demands to be believed and it demands to be disbelieved at the same time. And that conflict, I think, creates a space. And that space is where this creativity comes from. If to the extent that it's going to inform your creativity, that's where it comes from. It's this conflict between us being animals running around in the savannah and us living in a world that's like this.
Okay, another couple of questions before we finish.
My question, with the discussion, there's been a lot about death and anxiety, but historically, looking back at before the Renaissance, the whole idea that humans are the only animals that can recognise death. I think, from my understanding, that's where religion has come from. So we're aware that we're going to die, so we've created a life after death. And I think in the Renaissance, all of those artists and those thinkers, they had religion to back them up. They had that to dispel their anxiety. So there wasn't so much anxiety in their work because there was religion to help that. And then I guess through more modern times, along came science. And, you know, even when you were speaking about all those poets that had all that angst and that angst from Germany in that specific time of the 19th and 20th centuries, religion was taking a back step to science. So there was more anxiety to take care of our fears than religion to take care of our fears. So through the discussions today, I'm hearing anxiety and fear and death, but I just want to know what delineates anxiety and fear, if there's a rational fear or being anxious about something that's about to happen or just fear in general.
That's one for you.
Well, I would just say that the distinction I just made is probably the one helpful way to think about it. You know, anxiety in some way is just a psychologization, if I can use that word, of fear. It's this idea that it's a psychological state that doesn't have much to do necessarily with the material reality. On the other hand, it is terrifying in some ways to get up in front of people and play the piano. It is really frightening to wake up in the middle of the night, and death is frightening. So I wouldn't go too far with it, but I think it's somewhere in that neighborhood of whether or not the material conditions at the moment are really the inspiration for the fear.
Yeah. I mean, even with Jeff Koons having no anxiety, does that mean he just has no fear?
Maybe he has a lot of Valium, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. He just does whatever he wants because he doesn't have that questioning, perhaps. And I think, you know, through art education and writing and music, you're always questioning everything, and that's what can breed the anxiety, because once you start questioning or contradicting ideas, and that's what you do in these arts, that's a part of the creativity process. So that would create anxiety, I guess.
I quite like your distinction, or I quite like your characterisation of anxiety as being something that demands to be believed, and was that what it was?
And disbelieved
at the same time. And I think that speaks to a distinction, probably very simplistically, between our thinking and our feeling selves. And I think that's a very useful sort of locus for irony amongst other sort of modes of artistic expression. That's the place where that can exist.
So I've just got one more question. I'll have to be quite quick, I'm afraid.
I believe Peter differentiated between religious inspiration and anxiety as an inspiration source. Yesterday, Gary, you were talking about this history of crazy and how it had gone from a religious diagnosis, if you like, to this medical disease. I was just wondering whether you think that perhaps it's just a change of label. The religious inspiration is the same thing as anxiety.
Well, I think when you change the label, you change the nature of the experience. So they're not exactly the same thing. I mean, in broad terms, probably. But what we're really talking about is impossible to get at the raw phenomenon without language. At least that's what I believe. And the language does its best to approximate it, but we're stuck with the concepts that we inherit. You know, that's why Peter's comment was so interesting about the Renaissance. I mean, it's, you know, once you see it, it's, oh, yeah. The whole idea of what art is supposed to do may have changed. I mean, I guess that seems totally banal at this point. I don't know why I never thought about that before. But it's such a profound change that it no longer makes much sense to talk about whether or not they're the same thing, because they can't be in some essential way.
Okay, thanks for your questions, and I'm afraid we do have to wrap up now, but before we finish, I wanted to remind you that there's a festival bookshop and cafe in the Freemasons Hall 4 upstairs, and I think your book is up there, Anna. So if you'd like to go home...
So's mine.
so is Gary. Peter, any books up there?
No, not this one. No.
But if you'd like to go home with Anna's anxiety tonight, and please stay up to date on the... Festival of Ideas website and sign up to the e-newsletter. But thank you to our speakers.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.